So joining the Division of Trading and Markets in both those roles permitted the division to coordinate all of the enforcement activity, including the criminal activity, because the division was then responsible for the criminal reference work to go to the Department of Justice and the U.S. Attorneys. And in the enforcement area, we set up a very small unit first to do the national enforcement cases, and that eventually grew into a much larger unit. And I think really took off when Stan Sporkin became the associate director.
Well, you started it. Was it Tom Ray was the first one in that office?
Yes, Tom Ray was the fellow, and when he left to join one of the brokerage firms that had had a problem, he sued a brokerage firm, may have been the partner or somebody, and so they wanted somebody to go in and help their compliance, so they took him, and the interesting thing there is, when I asked him, who he was the chief enforcement officer. At that time, I was director by 1965. I asked him who he would want to appoint as his successor. And he said there were two people, Larry Williams and Stan Sporkin. And with some ambivalence, he thought maybe Stan Sporkin was the guy. And that was, of course, the best decision that we ever made on that side. And while I'm at it, on the other side, of course, we have Gene Rocker, who was equally the best decision that anybody could have ever made. One of the luckiest things I had was that when I had the two of them, I had Manny Cohen as chairman. I'm not sure how I could have done this with another chairman. I remember calling him and saying, look, I've got to have two associate director jobs. He only had one associate. I said, these guys are just fabulous, and I can't afford to put one over the other in their fields, and just absolutely the greatest people you could have for those jobs. And so Manny was good enough to recognize it for some assistance on my part that we probably should do it and put those in. And the results of that were, as you know, absolutely fantastic. I couldn't find anything better. So what happened is, going back quickly to just summarize, we were able, because of our national activities now, to really establish the prosecution of white-collar crime. The Department of Justice, Steve Rosenberg, who was the chief of the appellate section, became very close with us, and so we were really in a symbiotic relationship establishing the law in the white-collar crime area. So the U.S. attorneys would be referred by the Department of Justice to us in the litigation stages and sometimes in the appellate stages, assistance in their white-collar crime cases. The SEC became really the epitome of the agency that had the best white-collar crime prosecution. And after that period, you developed a whole white-collar crime prosecution, including organized crime, where we also participated because we had some infiltration of the organized crime people in later years, and so we worked with the people in the various task forces of organized crime as well.
It always struck me, and you can correct it one way or the other, that the SEC enjoyed a unique relationship with the U.S. attorneys around the country, which none of the other agencies that weren't directly in law enforcement enjoyed.
Yeah, we had excellent relationships both with the Department of Justice and with the U.S. attorneys in the field. For example, in New York, with Morgenthau, that was almost like an additional office to us. We would go up there and he'd give us grand juries that would be handling our cases. He would make his office available for our own investigative people. And we, of course, sent our people into the U.S. Attorney's Office. In the early years, some of our people had been appointed special assistants to the U.S. attorneys in some of the areas. But during Justice Clark's, he was the Assistant Attorney General there. There were some problems with some investigations of the department. And so he felt that wasn't a good practice. In more recent years, I know they have picked that up again and done that. But we also had an excellent relationship with the other parts of the Department of Justice, Solicitor General's office, because of the competence of the people at the SEC that I mentioned earlier. We were one of the few agencies that the solicitor permitted to argue cases in the Supreme Court. Roger Foster had argued the public utility American Power and Light case in the Supreme Court and had won that, of course. So that from time to time they permitted the SEC lawyers to not only write in the briefs, but occasionally to argue cases before the Supreme Court. And while we're on the Supreme Court, so I don't forget it, in the beginning, of course, with the conservative Supreme Court, the commission didn't have good success. But after the change in the hierarchy of the court, they did get a period where the Supreme Court was very supportive, particularly when Douglas was on the court, and so they were getting good cases decided. For example, during that period when Justice Goldberg was on, they had the capital gains research case, which was tremendously important in establishing the fiduciary responsibilities and anti-scalping claims. And now, more recently, you've had the cycle go the other way, where the court has eroded the effectiveness of 10b-5 by holding he couldn't have aiders and abettors, for example, except now under the statute, and has also limited its application. So you get cycles in this thing, and I think now we're in a down cycle where the courts are not as focused on giving the liberal interpretation to the acts that was intended in Roosevelt's message when he adopted it. You may recall he said that this act is intended to be liberally construed.
You mentioned before, and this is interesting, that in the enforcement activity that you started to appeal the court, not taking specific relief in the security statute, but looking to the general equitable powers of the court. And in other words, it always struck me, as you were saying, when you went to court, treat me like I'm another litigant. And as a litigant, I would be entitled to all kinds of ancillary relief in a proper case. That always struck me as a very creative approach for an agency who's, in one sense, is bound by the specific words and the relief in the security statute. And I was just wondering how that developed in the commission to look to the judicial power, as it were, for your relief, rather than believing you were constrained by the word of the security statute.
In part, it came about, David, because we were getting these decrees, but they had no teeth in them. And you always look about for something that can help you. What is it that you can do? And in looking at other cases, I was reading all the advance sheets, for example. I would run into cases where I would see these relief measures had been asked. Some had statutory powers to do. But in discussing the statutory powers, you can only find language in the cases that will say this is a part of the old equity relief. So using that background and having cases that were really egregious and going in, that was an important thing in enforcement. You picked your cases. You took, if you were going to make law, just like they did in the public utility case, they took the best case. They were being sued all around the country, you may recall. But they took the best case to take to the Supreme Court. We tried to do that in the enforcement area as well. We would take those cases. But as I mentioned before, one of the critical things was the attitude of the courts. That period, we were still in a period where we had good support from the courts. They were looking at the statutes in their totality and their global aspects as what were they intended to do. They were intended to protect investors. Conference report on the security awards and said, we're going to do away with caveat emptor now. We're going to have caveat emptor. That was recognized by the courts for many years. And as happens after a period of time, courts forget that, and so you get a more technical and strict the constrictive reactions and interpretations of court. So we were fortunate in those years that we had courts that were acceptable to fulfilling the purpose of these statutes. And to do that, if you were an equity judge, there was no reason for you to say that I can't use my powers. Remember, we were not asking now for expansion of the SEC's powers. We were saying, judge, you have a case, it's your injunction, you ought to make it effective. And so I think we were successful in that. You know, incidentally, just as we were successful in getting the Tunney Amendment passed for the antitrust laws as a result of the case that we had brought in the Vesco action, showing that they had been influenced by, or attempted influence by IPT on a decree. So I think the agency, from the very beginning, as I mentioned very early, had these tremendous people with such brightness, skills, abilities, who were looking at this in the area of how do we make it effective? How do we accomplish not just the technical part of the statute, but what we want to do is create a culture in the industry that we're responsible for, that quality, good faith, integrity, will in the long run give you greater profitability. And I think we have established that as a general thing, despite all of the restrictions and all of the failures that we've had. We still have the best capital markets in the world, and recognizing that there are a great deal of problems, as the present activities in the accounting area show. And I think that's one of our failures, that we were unable really to establish an effective system for the auditors to keep their independence so that they would perform in that function.
Come back to what the Commission might have done in other areas a little later, but I wanted to get back. You mentioned the special study a couple of times, and of course we have this round table on the special study, and I think you made a lot of your views known as you were one of the moderators at that panel. But looking at the SEC itself, internally, what impact do you think the special study has on the operations of the Commission going forward from the special study?
I think the special study was really responsible for the unfixing of Commission rates, ultimately. If I had had better recollection in my reading of it, I might have been able to have the Commission... discussing
the impact of the
special study. And I started to say, if my recollection had been better, I would have remembered that you forecast in the special study that there was going to be this tremendous back office catastrophe and the clearing catastrophe. And it came as a shock to me when I first was alerted to it as a result of reports that I received on a weekly basis of what the complaints were in the particular areas, and I recognized in that area was such, and we sent out a request to the brokers who were on the top 10 of the list to tell us why they were having these problems. It was only then that I backed up and I went to the special study and read your report, which was laid right out as if it was the contemporaneous there. I think that the whole capital markets trading system was affected by the special study. We wouldn't have pushed the NASDAQ thing had it not been for your people. We wouldn't have pushed the national market system. We wouldn't have, as I said before, fixed the commission rate. So I think the whole tenor of the commission was changed because it now got, as a result of that tremendous study, a better understanding of what was happening in the markets. I don't think the commission had that knowledge. It didn't understand it. And I think the special study just opened up a whole new avenue. And of course, Milton Cohen, when he came out with the integration of the 33 and 34 Act, also set the groundwork for that development, which has become very, very important to the Commission's accomplishment. I think the special study really started the Commission off on a whole new approach to its regulation of the markets. Took the emphasis off of the registration process, which was the big thing they were concentrating on, and put it into the context of really understanding how the markets operated and what the problems and issues were that the Commission had to attack. So I think it was really the greatest contribution of any study since the pre Security Act legislation in terms of directing the Commission's focus?
The Commission, during the 30s, have been involved in market regulation with respect to the New York Stock Exchange and the special system, etc. What happens after that to de-emphasize that area that then had to be almost rediscovered, as you put it, by the special study?
I think because the emphasis initially was on real corruption. You had the Whitney case. And so that was in the corruption part of the operation. It didn't really go to the operation of the exchange. I don't think the Commission really had the trading expertise or the knowledge of how that system worked. Even in the days that I was there, I think we didn't have as intensive an understanding of the internal operations of the specialist trading and some of the activities that were going on were inimitable to proper trading. You know, even with the NASDAQ, you had problems in terms of the trading abuses and doing that. Trading activities are such a sophisticated area that not many people know about it. When we were doing the unfixing of the commission rates, it was just astounding how the people who were running the broker-dealer firms had no knowledge of how the trading was being done. So that there again, the special study was really a education superb to the commission in giving it an understanding of how the markets work, in addition to educating the staff.
What would you say then, Gabe, you pick up something you were talking about before, that Bill Carey, in effect, sent you down with your general counsel's hat down to the trading division. That, you might say, was sort of one step in the centralization or the national approach to enforcement. Then, of course, some years later, that was followed up under Bill Casey by the establishment of a separate enforcement division altogether. Was that a development that was sort of in a straight line from Carey's first steps to then the creation of a completely separate division? How did that all come about?
Well, from my own personal discussions with Casey, I think it came out that one of the reasons, may not be the sole reason, was because I was both in the regulation and enforcement area, and we had some divergent views on how far things should be pushed in the regulation area. He was about to leave the commission, and he felt that if I was still in the regulation area, I might influence his subsequent successes to undo some of the things or to push in areas that I might have been more aggressive in than he was in terms of that. So that my personal feeling at that time was that he wanted to get somebody else to do the regulation so that my impact would be less effective in that area. Because the enforcement didn't change. I mean, the scope of the enforcement is the same. He may have felt that by concentrating it in a single division and giving it that might give it more effectiveness. But I remember talking to him when he was about to leave, saying, when we were discussing this, saying, I don't think, Bill, that you're going to be able to keep some of the things that you now have, that the events are going to overtake it, like institutional membership of exchanges, you remember, was a big thing, and so one way or another they were going to get it. And Casey was that kind of a candid, open guy, and I had that relationship with him, saying, you're probably right, Herb, but it's too late for me to change my mind in effect to do anything else. I think the advantage in having the enforcement and regulation together, particularly when you had two brilliant people like Stan Schwarf and Gene Rutberg, was that you could see the interaction of the two. And so regulation could support enforcement, and enforcement could support regulation. You didn't have to go convince somebody else to do something. You saw it right there together on how one could complement the other and make them more effective. So I thought that the two together were excellent. In terms of administrating the, both of them, maybe today Casey is right that there's exponential growth in them would have made it impossible for a management person to really do as good a job as two different people could do concentrating in their particular areas. So even though he may have done it partially for other reasons, I think maybe the division in the long run proved to be an appropriate one.
Again, staying with the development enforcement, when you went down to the trading division, the general counsel's office, did the regional offices perceive at that time that this is going to result in a shift in the centralization in Washington? Or did they ever perceive that? Did it just sort of grow by itself?
In the initial stages, of course, we were fairly limited in what we were doing at a small group. Eventually, you're right. There was some jealousy that developed, I can remember, from, let's say, the New York office calling Stanley and complaining that the office was doing some cases. But as you recall, I mentioned early on that we had kind of shifted the home office from a supervisory role in the enforcement area to a service role, and that helped us. Because when we began the national program, most offices were so great in having us have somebody that could help them or to take over cases from them, and they had enough to do. So it was only when we really got a big case, and I would say principally this was New York. I never remember any other regional area ever calling Stanley or calling me and saying, why are you guys doing this particular case? Well, why are you doing that? So it may have been because New York was more prominent in the people who were coming in and going out, more of a turnover than we've had in the other offices where they had established their reputations and didn't need that kind of stuff. But you're right, that the centralization, you'll always have that problem that people will say, why did you steal this case from me? We should have done it, not you. Particularly as these cases became much more important in the public arena.
Visible.
Yeah.
What would you think, and I'm not talking now in terms of a particular chairman or a particular commission, for what areas you believe, looking backwards now, which is unfair, of course, to the people who were there at the time, what areas do you think the commission underemphasized in the years past?
We were probably not as rigorous in the trading area as we should have been. I mean, we were attacking the over-the-counter area. I don't think we really put enough emphasis in the exchange area. And probably not as much emphasis in trying to push the national market system in that area. I think also in the analytical area, I think we missed the boat. We didn't understand some of the conflicts in the analyst community that are now surfacing. I think that we probably were not as effective in the IPO area, and you see it with the technology IPO area probably could have been prevented in part if there had been more intensive inquiry and investigation of how these IPOs were being promoted and what the interests were in the particular people who were doing that. As I look now, that gets back to my point that one of the failures is to prevent things from happening because you don't see what's going on. You're so involved in handling the particular day-to-day matters that you don't understand the others. And that was the genius of the special study. You were able to divorce a group of people and put them out so that they understood that. And now we're seeing some of the IPO practices belatedly that probably could have stopped some of the overreaching that occurred and some of the bubble that occurred in the technology area. So I think, generically speaking, as I look at any agency, I think the ability to divorce off and get a group of very bright, talented people to really try to understand the basic operations of an area from the ground up is critical for the agency to be able to do its job. Otherwise, it's kind of trying to hit the particular problem of the day. And the accounting area probably is the epitome example of that. You now have an accounting practice that is breaking down. The auditing function is breaking down. And if you go back and look at it, it kind of creeps up. When I was there, one of the problems we had was with independence. How far should we permit the accountants to go in their auditing and non-auditing services? And I see now it was a mistake to open that area up. The more you open that area up, once you let somebody get in the door, it starts to expand where now the non-auditing functions are really the profit in that business. The auditing is second class. And I think probably that inroad has caused the present problems as much as anything else, because it's critical to maintain that independence of the auditor. And the conflicts are so great. I'm just reading in the paper, I think, today, where somebody said the conflict is so tremendous. Remember, the managing partner, if he lost Enron as his client, he's out of business. He's lost his whole thing. And so that conflict, which exists, particularly now when you have non-auditing services that are probably giving more revenue than even the auditing, you have that critical function. So I think the accounting area is also one where those mistakes were made, but that's hindsight.
The commission has always leveraged its scarce resources by depending upon, in a sense, co-opting the professionals, the lawyers and the accountants. Sort of paraphrase the line of Stanley's in the Keating case, where were the lawyers, where were the accountants? How would you characterize the commission's success or lack of success? You just touched upon it with the accountants, but do you have any further thoughts on how the commission itself has been successful or unsuccessful, and as I say, leveraging its resources by working through the profession?
I think I have to start at an earlier point. I think that the commission was successful in establishing a principle of self-regulation or self-discipline in the brokerage community. I think that was a basic success, because the commission, as you pointed, with its scarce resources, can't be there looking every day over what's going on. And so I think we do have a better culture in the management of financial institutions, including, for example, the mutual fund area. There, I think the success has been absolutely unthinkable in terms of how well it has worked in that area. In the broker-dealer area, it has probably not has been as successful, but you still have that culture that was instilled because of the supervision responsibility initially, and the recognition that if you got good compliance, it's going to keep down the cost and losses as we can solve from your malcreants who you'll always have in those areas. Turning to the legal profession, I think that was a critical development, because you did have reputable people in this industry, in the professions, who were advising their clients in the highest ethical standard. And you had a group of lawyers out there, some of whom were adversaries initially, some of whom were trained at the commission and who went out, who established that kind of culture among the professions, that the best advice for their clients was in compliance with the law and not an attempt to corrupt it. That may have been being eroded now because of the change in the business competitive area that the profession has taken on. I think that is a deleterious thing that somebody as old as I am recognizes, because I remember back in the early days, those ethical things were ingrained in me, and I see them being eviscerated in the tremendous drive, because they're now becoming more of a business entity than a professional entity, if I could describe it in general terms. I think that's been the greatest change in the profession, and I think the SEC still has a group of professionals out there who respect the agency and understand their clients' best interests. But whether it is as great as it was some years back, I'm not sure.
Getting back to your career now, personally, how long did you serve as a commissioner?
From 1974 to 1980, 6 years.
during your time as a commissioner, what activity or action taken by the commission itself do you think were the most significant? If you could separate all the rest of the time you had the commission.
It was very difficult for me to pick out certain things. You know, I can remember the negatives more than I can the positives. For example, my own personal view, and I think it was shared by Evans, is that our failure to be able to convince the commission they should oppose 2018, I think was a basic error, and I still believe it's a basic error. Partially based on my experience in the enforcement area, I realized it was opening up a cookie jar, and it was the worst thing to do. I'm not sure now that the 12B1 plans, which I also was against, was not a bad practice. So I remember the negatives now. In the positive areas, I really can't think of anything, and that may be because remember the things I was personally involved in. When you're sitting at the commission, it's more in a consensus area. Now, I think one of the accomplishments of this, I give basically to Stanley, is the Flowering Growth Practices Act. I mean, that he single-handedly was able to do with Proxmire. I think Hills objected, wasn't in favor of it. And Stanley, as a result of the enforcement cases that we had brought, was able to do that. So that I would think is an accomplishment. The other thing is really in the international area, although it really wasn't a commission function, we established a relationship first in South America with the people down there trying to create commissions, and that was effective in getting the first real oversight of the capital markets in that area going as a result of the organization that was set up with the Canadians, South American, and the SEC in doing that. And that, of course, ultimately has led to IOSCO because everybody else wanted to get in. So that one of the accomplishments was to demonstrate to the world that the SEC's regulatory system was one that was probably the best in the world. And while, for example, the British had thought it was lousy, now they have come around to it, and the rest of the world has. So I think that is one of the accomplishments that was started, certainly, by the commission then and our participation in the various groups that were set up. I really can't think of anything other that we did that I would think was so extraordinary. Of course, the commission rates were unfixed in 1975, but that had pretty much started before. So I think we were just piggybacking on that and had done that. There was some movement in that area in setting up the composite quote system and that. But most of that had already been started, and so the impetus was there. So I can't remember anything that, without going back and looking at it. If I thought, the funny thing is, I can remember the older stuff better than I can remember the newer stuff. If I looked at the annual reports, I could probably point out some of the things, but I can't think of off the top of my head.
What effect on the commission itself did things like the Government Sunshine Act or Freedom of Information Act have?
I think the Government and the Sunshine Act really was not completely positive. I think that what happened was instead of having the discussions in the open meetings, you have to do them indirectly through clerks or somebody else in discussing that.
You having discussions in closed meetings?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. You can only, in a closed meeting, you could only discuss things that were exempted. You couldn't discuss.
Yeah.
But in the days that I were there, you could really have a good discussion on things other than enforcement matters in a closed discussion. So you could get out a lot of the things. So you've got the surface of open in the sunshine,
but you still have this being done some way other than in an open discussion, because they're going to do them by memorandum or something else that's going to serve them. So I think that was not a completely beneficial act. Whether it prevents corrupt activities in the Navy, I'm not sure. So it did have a limitation. But there's always the agencies find a way around it. They can still do it indirectly if they can't do it directly in the open meeting. I think the FOIA is probably beneficial in preventing things from being concealed. But there's always that conflict between open discussions and the ability to sit down and really have an intensive discussion where you can argue things out and get the benefit of it. So maybe with the FOA, you don't really need the Sunshine Act. But, you know, you see today things in the political area that cause you to have concerns when people don't have to reveal all of the contacts that they've had. But the commission, at least the SEC, in a different area, because it doesn't have the ability to lobby it as much, I guess. I think I may be wrong on that. And you can probably call up a commissioner and talk to him. There's no inhibition on that. So I think it's a mixed bag.
Over its history, the SEC has had a few internal integrity problems, but by and large has an incredible record of being free from those kinds of problems, as against other agencies of government. So what would you attribute this very clean record?
First of all, that was one of the most critical things for us. In my stay at the commission, we had only one case where we criminally prosecuted an SEC employee who happened to be a legal assistant to a commissioner who attempted to influence Joey Abrams' case. And because we found out he got the payoff through assistance of buying some property here in Washington, Nate Salmon, I remember, was the person who I used to get the facts, and we successfully prosecuted that case. The commission, whenever we've had anything like that, I also had another individual, one of those attorneys, who had engaged in trading without reporting. Remember, just engaged in trading without reporting. And so once I got a suggestion that there might be something going on, put people on that, some other things, put that in emphasis, and discharge that person. So that there was always an emphasis that in our own our own practices, we had to be in the highest integrity. It reminds me of something that I used to say when people would raise the question with me. Is it legal to do something? Is it legal to do this? So that's the wrong question. We have to ask, is it fair? Is it proper to do it? Whether you can legally do it or not, as a government agency, we can't apply that principle. We have to have a higher standard. You don't do it if you don't think it's fair. So that really helped us, because before they had the duty to advise people of their rights, we were doing that. We did all of those things in anticipation, because we saw them coming down the road that they were going to do it. So we did that. But it was a priority project in the commission. If you saw something that wasn't right, you went after it. And that reminds me of Brad Cook. When that began to break, he called me up to his office. And he had some person who was his assistant. I don't remember the name of the fellow. And I had read in the paper, all I knew about it, I had seen a little article in the paper about the Stans Mitchell thing. And his apparently meeting with them in Texas somewhere. And I said to him, look, I don't know what you did, but my advice to you is either, I asked him first, had he now met with Stans, or I think it was Stans, and I said, was there another person there when you met with him? Yes. I said, well, they're trying to set you up, like the Paul guy here. So you have your choice. You should either go up and tell the U.S. attorney everything that happened, or you can claim self-incrimination. Not say anything. Saw him the next day, as I was coming to the commission, he's coming out. He said, "Going to take your advice. He's going up there." And, instead of doing that, as you know, he perjured himself and various things. So it's that kind of thing that we attacked after that, of course, we were working with the U.S. attorney on the case, and we were responsible for bringing the indictment against these people. And while we weren't successful because of his perjury, it opened up to later prosecutions and was successful. So I think the agency always put the integrity in the forefront. If we were going to regulate, we had to be the cleanest ones in the business. So wherever there was even a smell or an odor of anything that was inappropriate, that's where we put all our focus. And I think that's been probably what's responsible for maintaining its integrity. That culture, you know, when I came, there was never a suggestion of corruption. These people weren't in that job for money. They could have gone out and potentially made more money. They were in there because they believed in the efficacy of these acts and in their purpose. And that was its great strength. It came from the beginnings of the commission. That is still the culture that carried on for years. And so among the people who stayed there for years, you had that intense public interest, public service thing. And I think we found that over the years, there were people who remained who had the same philosophy and who found the same satisfaction in terms of being able to do that kind of a job. Indeed, when I used to speak with assistant U.S. attorneys who would revolve over and over again, the one thing that they would say about their own professional activities, that they missed the fact that they could be in a professional job where they were really doing something that was accomplishing something in the public interest, and where it was really something very challenging and substantial and significant, instead of some representing some person here on some little rinky-dink kind of case. I think that culture helped to keep the commission from the usual corruption that you found elsewhere. It also had, of course, very rigorous rules on what you could do when you're trading, and I think that helped as well.
There were always, from time to time, attempted political interventions in the commission. I remember you were involved in going way back involving Bobby Baker. Was that on a registration statement?
Yeah, well, typically what happened is people learn very frequently. That was the worst thing. The minute you tried to put some political pressure, whether it was Dixon Yates years later, it eroded, whether it was Bobby Baker or whether somebody else. What used to happen, and I think it was reflected in when I was nominated for the commission, and I went over to the Hill. I had no political, remember, no political base. Garrett had been the one who really was pushing, and he was the one who was responsible for it, helped by the practice. When I went over there, I received an open sesame thing, both from the Congress and from the press, because what you mentioned was so true. They looked at our agency, even the press, had a respect for the agency that had been engendered by its reputation over the years. And so the Hill was over there, and if I would get a call from some congressman's assistant, I would just say, look, this is not a case for the congressman to become involved in, and that would turn it off. So we had, over a long period of time, excellent relationships. Now, when we had the Otis case, and they went over to the Hill and got the chairman of the House Appropriations Committee to try and cut our budget and that sort of stuff, that was an aberration. I think over the years, our relationship with the Congress were excellent. I mean, they relied on us. That they wouldn't come over and investigate. They would come over and say, can you tell me about this or help me how to do with something like this line. Also, when we operate internationally with the FBI, we turned the FBI around. You know, under Hoover, they couldn't do anything with anybody else and that sort of stuff. Clandestinely, the people used to come to us and we would help them because they understood we were that kind of an institution. So all of those things kind of fit into the overall reputation that you refer to of the SEC. And you remember, it was rated in every investigation as being the most outstanding independent agency of its time. And indeed, there was one occasion when the GAO came in and spent a year or so going over our records and I guess send them, file the report with the Hill. And we received the call. The call said, would it be helpful to you if we released this report or not? We didn't know what was in the report, but we told whoever the congressman was it wouldn't be helpful. It never saw the light of the day. And you will recall, you can remember the name of the person who was responsible for over the Hill for going to the special study room, the congressman from Chicago. Remember that? Remember his name?
Chicago,
Warren
Harris?
No, you remember the name. I couldn't remember. He called Bill Carey and said to Bill Carey, would you like to have a legislative investigation as a result of the Ray case? And Carey happened to call me, and I said I thought it would be better to have the commission do it. And that's, of course, finally was that it was accepted by that congressman, to his credit. He could have made a big deal about it and had a lot of publicity to it, but instead of that, he yielded to the special study.
On the congressional side, relations to Congress, not involving specific cases or anything like that investigation, it's my impression, and I wonder if you share it at all, that over the years, the Congress has become much more active in regulatory matters falling under the commission's jurisdiction than in the past.
Yes, I think part of it, David, was due to the fact that, remember, as you grew exponentially, businesses became lobbying congressmen. So, for example, when the FASB tried to do something in the accounting area that the community didn't like, they would go over to the Hill, partially because they knew it was difficult to do anything at the commission, that the commission was fine and so damn independent, you couldn't do it. So the congressional area was one in which they went. I think you're absolutely right that in recent days they became much more interested in it than they were in the early days. Although in the very early days of the SEC's, they were very instrumental in getting the legislation through. And that's the whole Corker and Cohn area period, which is before my time.
Well, there came a time today.